The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
What's probably not appreciated is that Bangladesh itself has a lot of violence. All of the political parties have these thug-like gangs that kill people for political objectives, usually to advance the interests of their party or to diminish, you know, some attribute of their competitors. You know, these are not mass killings. Like, these are really intimate forms of violence. They really do like that machete that seems to be an instrument of choice. And so for many, I think within the Bengali context, that is the way you kill people, right? It is intimate violence that is incredibly gruesome, as opposed to kind of killing at a distance. The intimacy of violence seems to be a part of Bangladeshi political violence.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 20th, 2017. That's the voice of Christine Fair of Georgetown University's South Asia expert extraordinaire, talking about the small but incredibly densely populated nation of Bangladesh. Christine joined me this week to talk about this country as the would-be bomber in New York last week hails originally from Bangladesh, which has been restive with all sorts of political violence, including terrorism, of late. We talked about the country's history. We talked about its current governance, its relation to the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar, and we talked about the increasing numbers of Bangladeshis, both from Bangladesh proper and from its diaspora, who are finding their way to international terrorist groups. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 270, Christine Fair on Bangladeshi Terrorism. Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here with a special announcement about our episode next week, where we are going to have one year-end episode of the Lawfare Podcast in which we are going to take your questions. Not your questions tweeted at us, but your questions left on a voicemail box, area code 240-812-8498. That's 240-812-8498. Now, here's how this is going to work. When you leave a message on this voicemail box, you will identify yourself and ask a question, and please frame it in the form of a question, not a lengthy speech, because then we'll use somebody else's, and you'll direct it to a particular Lawfare contributor. Could be me, could be somebody else, could be somebody you read a piece by, had a question about. And what we will do is we will gather the most interesting questions and have the people to whom they are directed address them on audio. And we will string together a bunch of these for our final year-end episode. I have no idea how many of these they're going to be, and therefore I really don't know how long a podcast it's going to be. But you send us the questions, and we will do our best to get you answers. One more time, the phone number is 240-812-8498. Let's start with what happened in New York and who the perpetrator was, which is the reason we're talking about Bangladesh today. So, Christine, start us off with who did what in New York and how we should understand who he is.
Yeah, so the guy's name is Akayed Ula, and he's been living in the States for a number of years, and he's originally Bangladeshi. Most Americans probably don't know where Bangladesh is on the map. It's not a country that has figured prominently in the production of terrorists that have harmed the United States and its interests, at least in a way that, you know, your average American would know. So Bangladesh, if you sort of look at a map of India, it looks as if India in the east sort of has like an arm. And in that armpit of eastern India actually sits Bangladesh. And at one point in 1947, what is now Bangladesh was actually a part of Pakistan. Pakistan had two wings then, West Pakistan and East Pakistan. And so it came out of this movement in the early 1900s for an independent Muslim state to be carved out of the detritus of the Raj. So it, like Pakistan, was a product of political Islam that said that Muslims and Hindus can't live together, that Muslims will never have a fair shake in India because of the majority dominance of Hindus. And this became one of the driving explanations of what became the two-nation theory, and it was the basis of creating a Muslim state in South Asia when the British left. So Bangladesh has actually had a fairly quiet role in Islamist militancy going back quite some time. First, in many ways, it was a victim of Islamist militancy. Right after independence, the first thing that happened is that Bengalis really felt that they were being treated as unequal Muslim citizens in the Pakistan project. And in fact, their perceptions were quite legitimate. The West engaged in oppressive, brutal tactics that really sought to depress their cultural and linguistic heritage.
And just to be clear, Christine, explain the ethnic and linguistic distinctions between the center of gravity of Pakistan proper and Bangladesh, because it's really, you know, opposite corners of what used to be the Raj, and they're not really the same peoples, right?
No, that's exactly it. And actually, so that is where the early Pakistani leadership sowed the seeds of the state's destruction. So what is curious about the early what would become the leaders of the Pakistan movement is that they were actually from North India. They were Urdu speaking. And in the case of Jinnah, he didn't even speak Urdu. And they were arguing for a Muslim lands to be assembled into a country in the areas that were predominantly Muslim. And so that's going to be in the northwest of the Raj, which is now Pakistan, and what is now Bangladesh. So if we look at what became West Pakistan, which is now Pakistan, those leaders from North India brought with them a political culture and a language that wasn't shared actually anywhere in this new state. In the West, the plurality of residents were Punjabi, and they spoke Punjabi, in addition to other languages like Baloch, Pashto, Sindhi, Kashmiri, and a smattering of smaller languages. So in the West, there was no majority. It was divided by ethno-linguistic groups. And in South Asia, ethnic groups tend to track with language groups. So if you say Punjabi is your mother tongue, you will probably call yourself Punjabi. And I understand that's not always the case in multi-ethnic, multi-linguistic states. In contrast, the East was, in fact, nearly exclusively Bengali, which meant that in the early Pakistani state, a majority of Pakistan citizens were, in fact, Bengali. Now, not all of them were Muslim, and this would become a friction point with regard to with respect to how the West Pakistanis viewed them. So the West Pakistanis viewed them as lesser Muslims. They felt that they were tainted by the Hindus with whom they had the Bengali Muslims had much more in common. And so they viewed them not only as lesser Muslims, but they also viewed them racially. Many Pakistanis in what was then West Pakistan viewed themselves as being lighter in skin color, whereas Bangladeshis, in comparison, on average, they believed were darker. And so there was this combination of derision based upon their ethno-linguistic heritage, the belief that they were lesser Muslims because of their proximity to Bengali Hindus. So essentially, the West began prosecuting and persecuting a campaign of wealth extraction, of ethno-cultural repression. So the original state of Pakistan as devised made a number of choices that were very deleterious for the survival of the state.
So all of this kind of erupts in the early 1970s into an independent Bangladesh, right? So what? How does it all come to blows?
Yeah, so it really begins over the West's repression of their language. I mean, and in fact, there was a day that Bangladesh still recognizes as the national day of the Bangla language, when the West persecuted, and by persecuted I also mean slaughtered, poets and writers of that language. They really wanted to extirpate that language. And it really came down to that. Bangladeshis were not in the military. Pakistan was at this point led by a military dictator because they were not part of the British martial races. And they were excluded from politics because of a series of policies that the West devised precisely to keep them out of politics. And by the time we get to the 1970, there is a full-on insurgency. Bangladesh initially was very anti-Islamism because they felt as if they had been the victim of Islamism, both politically, economically, culturally, but also they became the explicit victim of a genocide that was based upon their ethnic identity. And it undermined this political philosophy of the two-nation theory that said South Asia's Muslims have more in common with other Muslims than they do non-Muslims, because in fact, this ethnic group felt more attached to their ethnic identity than their Muslim identity. And so Bangladesh goes through this very tumultuous period where it begins playing with or experimenting with secular democracy, but it doesn't last. Bangladesh's secular leader very quickly becomes an autocrat, and in fact, he was the father of Bangladesh's current prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, who is taking many pages out of her father's playbook to erect an autocratic state. There was a coup replaced by a person who was right of center, General Zia, and he rehabilitated the Islamists. There were a series of other coups where the Islamists continued to be recuperated. And Bangladeshis, by the time we get to the 90s, they're revisiting their identity. They're like, well, you know, we had eschewed our Islamism, but now that we have a Bengali ethno-national state for all intents and purposes, the idea of Islam and their identity becomes prominent again. Bangladeshis participated in the anti-Soviet jihad, something which isn't terribly well appreciated. They came back from Afghanistan with this jihadist ideology. At the same time, the oppression of Rohingyas in Myanmar or Burma was also ongoing. And there had been RSO, Rohingya Solidarity Organization, which was an early Rohingya Muslim militant organization that was also based in Bangladesh. So Bangladesh has had a very early participation in these global Islamist movements. We just haven't heard about them because we in general don't hear that much about Bangladesh. By the time we get to 2005, Sheikh Hasina, who's currently the prime minister, her rival was in power. She is the wife of General Zia, one of the early Bangladeshi military dictators who rehabilitated the Islamists. And she goes into governance. She relied upon these Islamist king parties, the Jamaat Islami, who ironically was the organization that was responsible for killing many Bangladeshis. So she brought these guys back into government, and under her watch, Bangladesh really steps into modern Islamist terrorism.
So let's pause there. So what does, when you say Bangladesh steps into modern Islamist terrorism, what does that mean? What's the complexion of this? Is should we understand this guy in New York to be, he's of Bangladeshi origin, but he's a person in the United States who appears to have been inspired by ISIS, right? So what's the Bangladeshi role in global Islamist terrorism that's Bangladeshi qua Bangladeshi?
Yeah, so the first phase of this history, most people would not have even heard of. These guys, they come back from Afghanistan, they come back to Bangladesh. Now, you'll remember the original Osama bin Laden fatwa of 1998 had five signatories. One of them was the guy who was in charge of Harkat-ul-Jihad Islami Bangladesh. So people were always confused about who was this fifth dude that signed the fatwa. But this he lingers in sort of academia obscurity because we don't really see what's happening in Bangladesh. So while throughout the 1990s, we see, Pakistan is full on prosecuting its jihad in Kashmir, it's full on prosecuting and supporting what will eventually, the warlords and then the Taliban in Afghanistan. Bangladesh is churning, right? This idea of, are we Muslim or are we Bengali first? This debate's churning throughout the 1990s. And you begin seeing groups calling for Sharia law. But these guys are not typically terribly violent, and they're not typically landing on international newspapers. Well, that changes in 2005, when in the summer of 2005, this group, which no one had heard of before outside of Bangladesh, detonates about 400 bombs in 63 of 64 of Bangladesh's districts within an hour. And to appreciate the logistical feat of this, Bangladesh has more navigable rivers than roads. So these were calibrated to not kill. Each of these bomblets were like the size of a pack of cigarettes. But it signaled that we could kill you if we wanted to kill you. And that guy's name was Bangladesh. And he's been subsequently caught and killed. And in the killing of him, the organization began to change. So in the early days of the early 2000s, after 2011, Bangladesh's terrorists were much more in alignment with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban than they were ISIS. And they tended to draw from, just like the Taliban, they had a very strong madrasa background. And they wanted to impose Sharia in Bangladesh, the kinds of stuff that we had heard before. But in the last several years, with the emergence of ISIS, Bangladesh has actually emerged as a really important place for ISIS to cultivate recruits, not only in Bangladesh, but equally importantly, in the Bangladeshi diaspora. So Bangladesh has actually produced more ISIS fighters than, say, India has. And it's done this through a combination of recruiters that are based in the UK and their ties with Bangladesh itself. And in fact, both ISIS as well as Al-Qaeda Indian subcontinent have identified Bangladesh as a place for competition. So in the last 5 to 6 years, the terror attacks in Bangladesh that are attributed to or claimed by Al-Qaeda Indian subcontinent or ISIS have exploded. But again, most Americans haven't been paying attention because they're what I call low-quality terror attacks. They had not until recently used suicide attacks. Their weapons of choice were, wait for it, a machete, not exactly a mass murdering weapon. And so if we look at the numbers of attacks that were ascribed to Islamists in the last 10 years, there were literally hundreds of attacks, but the average fatality was one person or fewer per attack.
So it looks sort of like more like just murders than...
They're murders, except they're politically motivated. Like, for example, they went after publicly homosexual men. They went after Bangladesh's secular bloggers. They're attacking Bangladeshi's religious minorities, who are still substantial in numbers. So they are certainly terrorists. They're issuing manifestos. We want Bangladesh to not be secular. We want Bangladesh to get rid of secular courts and impose Sharia. We want Bangladesh to be part of an Islamic state. So they're terrorist attacks, but if you took away their politics, which is what makes a terrorist attack different from a murder, they would exactly, as you say, they would just be gruesome murders. This changed last summer with the ISIS attack on a cosmopolitan bakery in Dhaka called the Holy Bakery. And these five guys, unsophisticated though they were, they really brought Bangladesh on the pages of the sort of landscape of global ISIS.
Don't assume we know. Walk us through what happened in that incident.
Now, by the way, the American government knows this is going on. The American government is increasingly imposing security upon its personnel. They had long ago shut down the Peace Corps program, which had reopened after decades hiatus. The U.S. government knows this is happening. The U.S. government is monitoring Bangladeshi terror groups. They're secretly asking for analysis of what's happening in Bangladesh. So the U.S. government knew what was happening, in part because Bangladesh had been sending ISIS fighters, not in the numbers of Tunisia or even France, not even on the same scale as Pakistan, but somewhere between Pakistan and India. And so Bangladesh, it's beginning to worry people that follow this. Last summer, five guys, they go into this upscale bakery in a pretty posh part of town. And the first thing that they do is they ask Bangladeshis if they will attest to being Muslim. And if the answer is yes, they allow them to escape. Some Bangladeshi Muslims refused to do that because they didn't want to abandon their non-Muslim friends. And this became a very long siege that ended up being very deadly by Bangladesh's standards. And part of the problem was that they were very early on identified as ISIS. And people assumed that meant high-trained, high-quality terrorist ISIS. What we now know is that most of the fatalities in the bakery was actually done with small arms fire and knives. But it really shook Bangladesh.
How many people were killed?
So 29 people were killed, including 20 hostages. So this is literally an order of magnitude of what these previous attacks had had. And the hostages were also high profile because 18 of them were foreigners. And some of those foreigners were, in fact, American Bangladeshi. And these guys, though they were not trained or resourced by ISIS, in fact, they were clearly not as competent as we would have expected them to have been had they been trained by ISIS. They did dedicate the attack to ISIS. They claim that they are ISIS, but are they actually taking orders from ISIS's leadership in Syria, or are these guys just franchising and trying to use ISIS's name to bring attention to their attack? And there's a lot of debate about that. Personally, I'm of the view it's generally of the latter, not of the former. ISIS's magazine, Dabiq, had even featured a few years back a Bangladeshi terrorist that went to ISIS and fought and died. So Bangladesh has been slowly creeping up on this. And as I said, both ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Indian subcontinent, have declared Bangladesh to be an area of priority, both in terms of recruiting, but also in terms of political activity. So not only are they interested in bringing Bangladeshis out of Bangladesh for attacks, they also want to target Bangladesh for attacks. And the other problem with Bangladesh, and this actually comes back to Mr. Ulla, who tried to kill himself and others in New York, the Rohingya situation. We don't, you know, this guy was fairly obscure. He wasn't on anyone's radar screen. But before he came to New York, he actually went back to Bangladesh, and he engaged in quite a bit of charity for the Rohingyas, most of whom are now in Bangladesh living in unspeakably horrific conditions, having survived unspeakably horrific atrocities. And when he got back to Dhaka before coming to the United States, he had expressed absolute outrage and despondency over the fate of the Rohingyas. And he had, you know, he actually raised and distributed quite a bit of money for these Rohingyas. And so it is interesting that based upon the last thing we know about this guy when he leaves Bangladesh is that he's not caring about Palestine. In fact, when you spend time amongst South Asia's Muslims, there's enough outrages at home that they might talk about Israel as a sort of abstract motivator, but they don't really commit acts of terrorism in the name of the politics of Israel and Palestine. So when this guy shows up in New York, if you were a betting person, you would have thought he would have done this to protest American quiescence and acquiescence to the slaughter of the Rohingyas, but instead he dedicates this attack to ISIS to protest American policies towards Israel, including Trump's declaration that Jerusalem is the capital.
Right. So when you heard that the perpetrator in New York was of Bangladeshi origin and had recently been in Bangladesh, how do you connect that to this history, recent and not so recent, that you just laid out? Is this an example of, as most Americans have understood it, a self-radicalized American ISIS adherent? Or is this an example of stuff going on in Bangladesh that's suddenly playing out in the streets of New York? Or is it not clear?
So I would say, A, it's not clear. We still don't know that much about him, even though he's a survivor. Based upon what we've read of him thus far, I actually think it's more of the latter. From at least what we know, and so with this huge caveat that this is incredibly premature to comment about him, it did seem as if he was really affected profoundly by what was happening with the Rohingyas. And, you know, I have to say, if Americans could even appreciate what this Rohingya crisis is, it is really outrageous.
But the Rohingya crisis is not a Bangladesh crisis, right? Bangladesh is where they're fleeing to, but it's really a Myanmar crisis.
So how is this a Bangladeshi crisis? Well, one, Rohingyas have always lived in Bangladesh. And when things became unlivable in Myanmar, they would come to Bangladesh. And going back to some of the early phases of Islamist mobilization, the RSO, for example, was based in Bangladesh. And right now, if you go to Bangladesh, the presence of Rohingyas there, it is absolutely inescapable. It is all over the place. Most of the terrorist groups that I follow are explicitly marketing the Rohingya crisis. So I look at Lashkar-e-Taiba, ISIS, AQIS. They are all making considerable hay out of the Rohingya crisis. So it's something that you can't really escape. And as I said, most of those refugees that have managed to escape in the most recent spasms of violence are in Bangladesh. So if you're a Bangladeshi and you are remotely, and by remotely I mean you're on Twitter, if you're anywhere near this Islamist milieu, this is going to be a humanitarian crisis that you're not going to be able to escape.
So your view when you heard about New York was that this is a guy who's been up to that region recently, who's come back to Dhaka and expressed fury about it, and then who shows up in New York and commits an act of violence in New York or attempts one, that this is, we should really understand this as the exporting of Bangladeshi strife to New York rather than what it appears to be, which is somebody who's a sort of self-radicalized US-based ISIS person.
So right now, based upon what we know, I think that's true. But, you know, again, with the huge caveat, we don't really know that much about the guy. And the one thing, and I know this is in poor taste, what, you know, we really lucked out that he was Bangladeshi, because Bangladeshi terrorists are actually quite incompetent. They're not, and like I said, you know, the typical device of killing that they've chosen, you know, have been machetes. The one experience they had with bombs were these little bomblets that were designed to not be lethal. So I wasn't terribly surprised that he was actually a failed terrorist.
When you say the Bangladeshi terrorists are incompetent, is that really a creature of their technical capability, i.e., that they're not good at these operations, or is the small bomblets and machetes a strategic choice?
So that, again, you know, is a really crucial question. And there's probably the combination, it's probably a combination answer. What's probably not appreciated is that Bangladesh itself has a lot of violence. So if you just look at, if you go to the Global Terrorism Database, for example, and you look at acts of terrorism, the majority of the incidents that appear are actually not attributed to anyone, or they are attributed to these gangs that are associated with the various political parties. All of the political parties have these thug-like gangs that kill people for political objectives, usually to advance the interests of their party or to diminish, you know, some attribute of their competitors. And so, again, these attacks will, you know, these are not mass killings. Like, these are really intimate forms of violence. They really do like that machete. That seems to be an instrument of choice. And so for many, I think within the Bengali context, that is the way you kill people, right? It is intimate violence that is incredibly gruesome, as opposed to kind of killing at a distance, right, where you shoot someone, you detonate a bomb. The intimacy of violence seems to be a part of Bangladeshi political violence. And what, even when we've seen the emergence of Bangladai, who was the guy behind the 2005 bomber, he actually morphed out of this milieu of left-wing political violence, which again was very intimate. So I think part of it, and I'm kind of going out on a limb here, is that this is part of the violent repertoire of Bangladeshi. So to your point, I wouldn't call it strategic. It's just how they kill people there. And they haven't had a lot of experience with mass instruments of violence. That's what made the Holy Bakery attack singularly different, because you had five attackers, you had, you know, 29 victims, which it just was a huge escalation of lethality. So this is where I sort of see Bangladesh. I see these ISIS fighters, by the way, differ from the Al-Qaeda Indian subcontinent fighters and all of the other indigenous Bangladeshi groups in one key way. They are not products of the madrasa. These are upwardly mobile, well-educated, middle-class young men. In fact, one of the Holy Bakery attackers was even the winner of the Bangladeshi version of American Idol. Not, you know, you wouldn't expect this dude to become an ISIS fighter. So there is a really significant phase shift in the kinds of people that are joining or ascribing these attacks to ISIS. They differ in virtually every way from the terrorists that came before them. And so I'm going to expect these new ISIS fighters to also try to distinguish themselves from the other acts of violence. And I think this is an example of that. But okay, they're not so trained at it. And so thus they're not good.
So let's look forward for a minute, and then I'll let you go. When you're describing a phase shift in tactics, that is, attempts at much greater lethality, some successful as in the bakery, some unsuccessful as in New York. You're describing a large number of events, although largely unnoticed, and a generally restive and violent political culture, as well as a pretty significant contribution to sending foreign fighters to ISIS, all of which makes me
and from the diaspora,
all of which makes scratch my head and say, should we be looking at Bangladesh as a possible major new contributor to terrorist violence globally in the coming few years? Or should we expect it to sort of keep percolating along with, you know, sort of machete attacks in the country itself and occasional Bangladeshis showing up in international violence, but basically not appreciable change from what we've seen so far?
So right now, because like I said, they've been doing this stuff for many years and they've not been terribly effective. Like, even these guys that, I mean, there'll be entire Bangladeshi families that leave the UK to go to ISIS. So a couple of the questions, I'm going to dodge your question directly by saying it depends on a lot of things. One of the things that I'm going to be very concerned about is what happens to those Bangladeshis who go home, right, who actually live through the Islamic State and decide that it's time to go back to their countries of origin or elsewhere. Now, countries are paying attention. I mean, the United Kingdom, they know they have a Bangladeshi problem. They've known for quite some time. I mean, they've been following Bangladeshis like they've been following Pakistanis. They keep close tabs on them. So will they return in the same way that they did from the Afghan jihad without any appreciable interest in large-scale jihad? Because that's really what happened when the Soviets were ousted. They went back home and they played around with Islamist politics, but they didn't become effective. They didn't become effective terrorist groups. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is really quite different, is that they've actually learned quite a bit and they actually take that knowledge back home with them. And so in that case, I'm more worried about, say, Bangladeshis of British origin than I am Bangladeshis of Bangladeshi origin, because they have multiple levels of competence, right? They can get here very easily without a visa because of the, you know, reciprocity of visa rules. They already have a level of international sophistication that a lot of Bangladeshis don't. So that's one subgroup that I'm worried about. And that's unfortunately one of those only time is going to tell. But my instincts are that it's going to be the latter scenario, that we're going to see these guys appearing episodically, that they're not going to be involved in mass terror attacks that are effective. I also see Bangladesh really more as a facilitating country. Bangladesh has long been a place where groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and other attacks that are targeting India have been staged and organized. Bangladesh has played that role for quite some time, and I don't think that is going to change. And in fact, I think it becomes more ripe as this government that's in power and in Dhaka continues her repression against any form of even legal Islamism. But I don't think I have to worry about Bangladesh as being the new Pakistan quite yet. It's not that that's impossible. It's just that I don't see those groups having the same competence, in part because the Bangladeshi state isn't growing terrorism, right? The Pakistani state grows terrorists as tools of foreign policy. So I don't see Bangladesh becoming the new Pakistan, for example, as Hussein Haqqani has recently written. But in terms of repression of its own citizens, in many ways, it's already there.
Christine Fair, Georgetown University, thanks so much for joining us. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Christine Fair for joining me remotely to talk about Bangladesh. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan, with whom I'm going to have a drink this afternoon. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. Tweet the Lawfare podcast. Share the Lawfare podcast on Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, Dig, 4chan, all sorts of other social media companies I've never even heard of. Of course, leave us that rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution service you use. And once again, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.